Renegade Broadcasting, hard-hitting talk radio.
Technically, tomorrow at noontime is the halfway point of July. Jeez. Remember, I was just saying a few weeks ago, here it is, the beginning of the summer. Watch, we're going to sneeze and blow our nose a couple times. And already just about halfway through July. Can't believe how fast the summer goes by. Remember when you were a kid and school got out and you thought, wow, got the whole summer. It seemed like forever, right? Years go by now the way that the summer season used to when I was a kid, maybe even faster. I mean, we're looking at, you know, close to 20 years ago since 9/11. Can you believe that one? Remember that like it was yesterday. Later this month, of course, going to have the 50th anniversary of the fake moon landings. Yay! 5 more days, actually. When is that? Saturday. Saturday will mark 50 years since the great staged event. And oh boy, you don't get more staged than that. That was done on the stage. I'm surprised there hasn't been a lot more hoopla. Or maybe there hasn't. I haven't been paying attention. I don't know. But you think there would have been, you know, more movies, more documentaries, more TV shows, whatever. But I bet on Saturday it's going to be all kinds of crap on the CNN Fox. Be talking about it. But a scam and a half. You know, I was thinking about this the other day, speaking of Apollo. Think about this for a minute. You know, when the Wright brothers first did their little experiment there, that's what kicked off air flight in modern times, right? It was 1910. 1910 is when they developed their first, you know, successful aircraft. 4 years later, aircraft were produced en masse. And of course, the first and primary application, as always, was war, right? But I mean, there were thousands and thousands of planes that were used for aerial warfare in World War I, just 4 years later. And within, what, another decade or two, you had airlines, you had everybody who's anybody that you know, that had the money, the general public, you know, had the potential anyway, to share in the benefits of this new technology. People were traveling to and fro in these newly developed airplanes. My point is, here we are 50 years out from Apollo, right? Don't you think by now we should be having shuttles running back and forth? Shouldn't there be a whole industry built up around, at least if not visiting the moon, or at least going out and orbiting it? I would be one of their customers, wouldn't you? Wouldn't you want to see that? Why don't they have on a daily basis, just like they have, you know, airlines traveling around the world every day. You can get a plane ticket to just about anywhere on the planet, right? Why don't they have that with, you know, moon cruises? There should be at least half a dozen or a couple dozen, you know, cruise companies to take you to the frickin' moon, or at least orbit you around the moon. Wouldn't that be a nice romantic thing? Take your woman and you, hey, look at that. Wow, what a view. 50 years later, and yet within just a few years after the Wright brothers' successful development of the first airplane, you know, everybody was flying high in the sky, right? Just on that basis alone, look at the problem we have here. You know, the naysayers, the ones that don't believe that the whole moon landing was a fraud, just ask them that question. Why is it not readily available for everybody? 50 years, folks, 50 freaking years. Not only is the general public not able to fly in a shuttle and orbit the moon, they themselves haven't even gone back. So what the hell makes you think they ever went in the first place? Once you develop a technology, once you break new barriers and expand to new horizons, you continue to run with that, don't you? You don't just do it and then stop. Anyway, we got a real fan of Apollo on the line here. Welcome, Brian.
Good evening, Charlie. I was hoping that you would have had this entire show for Project Apollo to celebrate the 50th anniversary.
Yeah. I should, actually, because I got several other notes I put together on that topic. Yeah, maybe next week I will, if I finish the current one. I just hate to leave something hanging in the middle, you know.
Yeah, I agree with you. Like, you know, you want to get on to your subjects of history, and that's always important. But, of course, next week I won't be able to join in. I'm on vacation next week, and I'll probably be in parts unknown, and I will be in a place with limited internet access. So listening to your show actually will be impossible.
Well, have a good time, wherever that is.
Yeah, you know, I'm like you. I've known since 79, that would be, what 40 years I've known that Project Apollo is a fraud.
Oh, no kidding. Wow.
Because I was exposed back in my university days. Well, you got to understand, I took physics in university. And one of the things I was studying was radiation. It was one of my professors that told me in the winter of 79, I guess it'd be February 79, he said, by the way, Brian, you're a pretty smart dude. Let me fill you in something about history. You know, all the stuff about Project Apollo from 67 through to 72. I said, yeah. He said, well, I'm just going to give you a tidbit. It was all a fraud. And then he spent days afterwards, sometimes when we were in study groups and that, explained to me how they did and why they did it. And I'll tell you something, for a young impressionable mind, it was a shock. Because I'm like you, when I grew up, when I was 9, 10 years old, I watched the launching of these craft and I thought, wow, we're sending men to the moon. Isn't that so fabulous? And, you know, and I had... And I actually had one of those glue mock-ups, so you like the Saturn V rocket I actually built. You remember like the plastic pieces you put together and build a rocket?
Yeah,
I had one of those, and I had astronauts, and I played with friends talking about, wow, isn't that great? Hey, Apollo 14, Apollo 15, wow, isn't that so fabulous? And it was like everybody watching in horror the Apollo 13 flight and the rescue and the astronauts made it back to Earth after that disaster going towards the moon, only to realize years later was all a scam, every single one bit of it. Because let's face it, like, you know, you were talking about quickly about some of the aspects, but the fact is the Saturn V itself was a fraud because the F1 engine could barely get it off the ground. There was no way it could generate 1.5 million pounds of thrust. I think you and I discussed that before. The problem was that American rockets are shit compared to Russian rockets. That's the reason why even today they have to use Russian rockets to reach the International Space Station. American rockets fall apart.
You don't have to worry about swearing on this show. I'm the swear king.
Yeah, sorry about I'll mind my manners as I'm telling you about it. Yeah. But anyway, the Russian rockets are far superior, far better construction, far better alloys. If you watch a video, and I watched one was sent to me a while back, about the Apollo 6 test flight, 1967, early 68, the Apollo 6 almost exploded on the test flight because the engines, the F1 engines, were so bad that it actually experienced what was called a burn through. And it almost caused the whole craft to explode. Apollo 7 barely got off the ground, only made it to low Earth orbit. And yet they claim that Apollo 8 suddenly went all the way to the moon and circled the moon and came back.
Armstrong was not able to land the one that they had wasn't even as good as the actual lander, right? But even that wasn't able to be successfully landed. He had to jettison out, remember? You know, we use a parachute.
That was a test of the prop LEM on Earth. They used jet engines. And they were trying to get him to learn the aerodynamics of trying to land.
He couldn't stabilize it. The thing crashed. Yep. And yet they still sent them when they didn't do anything to modify the system that they had in place already. I mean, how in the hell could they even have done that when obviously, you know, all their lives were in jeopardy, right? They just flipped the coin and said, yeah, let's go for it, even though we haven't worked the bugs out of this thing yet. I mean, that's really what they did.
Exactly.
I mean,
here's the problem. The LEM itself, built by Grumman Aerospace, $7.2 billion project for that concoction. Basically, they reused the same LEM again and again and again between 11, 12, 14, 15, 16, 17. It's exactly the same LEM. A fellow Canadian named Scott N. Henderson showed the proof by examining each LEM so closely as a photographic expert, and he discovered that each one was exactly the same. They just reused the same prop again and again and again. And here's the problem with the LEM. There's no way it could have worked anyway because it had a reverse thrust engine for its landing. Now, the technology for reverse thrust engines using a rocket to land had not been perfected until finally SpaceX recently was able to land its two booster rockets using reverse thrust engines back over the last 3 years. So that and we're led to believe that in 1969 they were able to do it then. Something's very wrong there. That's the problem with the main landing engine. But the secondary engine, the one that's supposed to take off, cause the upper stage of the LEM to pop off and fly the astronauts back into orbit, was impossible because there was no venting for the engine's hot gases. Basically, we are led to assume that this thing would suddenly pop off and same thing ignite and fly all the way up to the command service module orbiting the moon. But here's the problem. Because of no venting, that engine, if the moment it would be ignited for the liftoff from the moon, it would have exploded. No venting. It had no venting at all for its hot gases to escape. Right. So basically, Grumman knew it was a prop. I mean, it always was a prop. But American taxpayers paid $7.2 billion in 60s to 70 money for that. Go on.
I saw the Pentagon got approval for, I forget now, 700-something billion-dollar budget increase. Are you freaking kidding? How many times have they reported now? Of course, they did so right on 9/11. But since then, they've done it again. I don't even know what it's up to now. Like $5 trillion total that they claim has been misplaced. And yet they're still being awarded billions and billions more. It's unbelievable, man.
Yeah, well, there was a reason.
We have to also ask, where did the money go for Apollo? We know where it didn't go.
Well, we can always say the state of Israel is one place. Dark projects. More money for Israel. That's where most of the money probably disappeared.
As
the
always.
Fact is, too, that, like I said, besides the fact the rocket couldn't get off the ground, off of Earth, it was barely able to attain low Earth orbit. The LEM was impossible to use. And, of course, you and I talked many times about the shielding issue. There's interstellar radiation, because everyone talks about the radiation of the Van Allen barrier, you know, the plasma fields of the planet. But beyond the Van Allen belts, of course, you have interstellar space, which is riddled with radiation. Every time the sun has a solar flare activity, is throwing out heavy particles, and these particles would have bombarded the service command module and the LEM as it began its trip towards the moon, because there is no shielding.
Right.
Everyone claims that aluminum is shielding. No, aluminum is the worst thing possible for shielding, because when heavy particles hit aluminum, it causes what's called a fragmentation effect, generating, of all things, X-rays within the craft itself.
That doesn't even cover the problem of what protected the astronauts from solar and extra solar radiation while out in space. A friggin' tin can? I mean, are you serious?
Yeah, and then there's the temperature problem. I keep on explaining to people, like, when you're flying through space and you're being hit directly by solar radiation from the sun, you're gonna heat up in a craft up to 250 degrees Fahrenheit, and you'll be dead long before you reach that. Now, NASA claims that they were able to solve that heating problem by basically having the craft slowly rotate as it made its travel towards the moon. And I'm thinking, you got to be kidding. This thing's heating up.
Oh, so they were on a rotisserie.
Yeah, that's exactly what it would be like, a rotisserie.
Oh, my God.
And then, of course, you land on the moon, and the moon itself is, like you and I talked about even on your old Oracle days, the moon is highly radioactive. Yeah. I explained to people for a long time that when you look at the moon in X-ray light or ultraviolet light, it glows because it's pouring off radiation.
Yeah.
That solar surface has no atmosphere. It's been bombarded by interstellar.
And that radiation alone would have exposed the film and those cameras right through the camera door.
Absolutely.
Yeah, what a joke.
Yeah. Hasselblad cameras. And here's the problem. The Hasselblad.
Unmodified. They were not modified to, accommodate the harsh lunar environment. And yet we're supposed to believe that, those pictures came through perfectly crystal clear without any radiation staining. Not to mention that it's extremely cold and extremely hot on the lunar surface, depending on whether or not you're in the open sun or in the shade. Yep. So the film should have either frozen and cracked or heated and melted.
Yep.
Take your pick.
Yep.
Never mind the radiation.
Some researchers discovered that the film they used was standard Kodak Ektachrome 110.
Very delicate material, yeah.
It was very delicate. But here's another issue that was brought to my attention recently. The vacuum of space also would have caused the film itself to disintegrate. Huh. It would have caused an effect called outgassing.
Yeah.
A strong vacuum forces materials to actually secrete any stuff that
any liquid at all. Well, the same with your blood, right? You've got that one footage where the astronaut's glove was not attached to his suit and you can see his skin. That would have caused the blood to boil right out of his veins.
Yep. There was one famous picture from, I think it was Apollo 16, showing one of the astronaut's gloves, and the tip of the glove is missing. His fingers were fully exposed inside.
Oh, yeah.
If this is supposed to be a pressurized gauntlet, he would have been dead instantly.
Hey, one of my favorite ones, you've probably seen these, there's two of them, where they're making noise on the moon. One is when they're hammering the flag. The other one is even more troubling because somebody could say, well, he had a microphone on his glove. But no, the footage where, I forget now which astronaut, but he's throwing a cord and it flings across and hits the leg of the LEM.
Yep,
and it makes a big clank noise. There was no microphone that could have picked that up.
Absolutely, because you're right. It was the Apollo 12 mission where he took a hammer into the stake, and one of the astronauts said, "Gee, I can't believe we were able to hear it." Basically, and the other guy says, "Well, there shouldn't have been any noise on the moon," and he's correct. And yet, NASA's claimed, they even used to have an old website for children. It was actually taken down, which shows the definite proof that you cannot have sound on the moon at all. But you're right about the other one. Throwing that cord across the thing shows a definite thud. And then, of course, you have the fact that there was also a video where it shows a bag attached to the lens that's actually flopping away as it's hitting some air. And then they had to cover it to prevent the flopping.
Right. Yeah, I remember that.
No air on the moon. Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God, man. What a joke.
But
they really take us for just complete suckers. And unfortunately, people actually are.
Yeah. But Charlie, the whole point is it was all a money-making scam. It was also done for prestige because the United States was, losing its – a lot of the American citizens were turning against the U.S. government because of the Vietnam War.
Sure.
They needed something to try to regarner American prestige and make – to make it look like America's great rah-rah, just boom, bah, apple pie and all that. So they blasted off these missions at just the key times. Like, think about all that was going on during Apollo. The United States had lost began to withdraw from Vietnam after the Tet Offensive of 68. And basically, they didn't want to admit defeat. And if the American public was still very much against the war, because, of course, Nixon, rather than try to pull the forces out and try to remove American involvement in Vietnam, he actually accelerated it by doing all the bombing of where Vietnam started. But the cover for that, they just had the Apollo 14, 15, and 16, 17 missions.
Yeah.
All at key times.
Well, did you hear my point at the beginning of the show, though? You know, what's that?
Well, go ahead.
You know, why is it that 50 years out, we don't have, like, you know, a moon cruise company, you know, taking people out to at least orbit the moon, if not land on it, 50 years later, when, if you look at the Wright brothers, within 4 years, they had mass-produced planes, so they would be being used on a grand scale in World War One. Not long after that, they were establishing airlines, and people that had the money were you know, buying their own private planes. And, you know, that should have been all the more with space now, right? Look at the money. Do you know how many people would want to go out in space? I would. Wouldn't you?
There's three factors that come into play. One is, of course, the radiation problem. If you want to send passengers.
If things work the way they want us to believe they did, we should be going to the moon already by now. Everybody should be having access to be right?
Absolutely.
50 years later, this is plenty of time for companies to have perfected the technology better and made it more safe from mass transit. No, there has not been any effort. NASA itself hasn't even, quote, return to the moon, let alone, you know, make it available to the public.
Because they never went there in the first place.
They
still haven't solved the problem.
Why don't people ever stop to ask questions like this? If, in fact, we went there 50 freaking years ago, why isn't there a booming industry now for tourism to take advantage of this new technology that they have created, you know?
Well, if you think about it, Charlie, what they did, too, to blind the American public, they put forward all the science fiction shows, and they created the movies like 2001, A Space Odyssey, you know, to basically create the illusion that all this is possible, you know, that the technology is there to do it. Little did they tell the people, but all these movies were just a fantasy. You know,
the technology is there to create the illusion that they did it.
Absolutely. Sound stages, like the Northern Arizona sound stage that they used for Apollos 14, 15, 16, and 17, are still there.
Obviously, it was pretty crappy technology. If they'd only waited till like George Lucas came around a few years later, they could have done a more impressive job. You know, I mean, really, when you look at it, it's pretty crappy. It's pretty chintzy. You know, it looks like some kid did it in his basement or something. Really, bad.
Well, yeah, but the other fact that's bad is their usage of computer technology, which I wanted to talk to you about one of these times. Is the real joke, because back in my college days and even before that, I remember how primitive the computers were. Like, people don't realize the computer used for the Apollo missions was basically nothing but a piece of shit because it used rope core memory. It didn't have advanced integrated circuit technology that we use today, rope core memory. And there's a great guy named Pascal out of France that used to send me information I poured over for a long time about the computer, the fraudulent computers used by Project Apollo. And he's right. He showed how there's no way that the computer could have stored memory, could have been used for anything that they claim, like, you know, for navigation control. Impossible, because computer itself could not work.
Right.
All it was an elaborate prop with some nice little numbers on it and a useless piece of hardware. So what did they use to navigate to the moon?
Exactly.
Unbelievable. Anyway, old buddy. Like I said, I think I've spilled my guts long enough. You have your regular show to take care of it, don't you?
Yeah. Enjoy your vacation.
You too, Ben. Like I said, keep in touch and let me know over the next week or two if I'm able to get access to my emails. Let me know if you wanted to do another whole show on any subject that you want to touch on.
Yeah, sure. Anytime.
You have a good night, Charlie. And just remember, like you said, NASA, the U.S. government are going to be rah-rah, sis, boom, bah in about 4 days.
Yeah, yeah.
It's going to be amazing. And so many people are going to swallow it without any thought.
Oh, yeah. As always.
As always. Have a good night, old buddy. Talk to you later.
Yeah, take care, man.
Bye-bye.
All right, guys. Let's get back into our discussion from last week here. Solomon, i.e. Amenhotep III. By the way, I mentioned briefly last week about the the Freemasonry factor, and I forgot to mention, in fact I haven't even added that into these notes yet, I had forgotten about it somehow. There's a Masonic website, I think it's called the Masonic Trowel or something like that. I intended to include that, and I don't know, somehow it got lost in the shuffle. But there's a very interesting quote on that website where, and that's an official Masonic website, by the way, but Freemasonry attributes the origin, the ultimate origin of Freemasonry to Amenhotep III, who is the Egyptian pharaoh that we are now connecting with Solomon. They actually trace the origins of Freemasonry to this same pharaoh. Now, is that not a kick in the ass? That is very, very telling, isn't it? No wonder they have such a fascination with, quote, Solomon and with Egyptian iconography, because it's not Egyptian at all, is it? It's their hijacking of Egypt. And their Solomon is actually a Hyksosian pharaoh, Amenhotep III. But I that blew me away when I saw that. Wow. Wow. Very interesting. Anyway. And so when, you know, the great Jesus comes along and it's claimed that he's a son of David and Solomon, well, guess what that means? I got a very important show coming up on Jesus' Egyptian connection, but, you know, that's another show. All right, guys, we're back with this Solomon. We're going to get back to Twitter.
Most of you are already aware that the sick freaks ruling our world are engaged in some of the most horrific crimes against children imaginable. This dark and depraved underground is something any healthy person would not even want to consider. But we must investigate their operations and expose these criminals to the light of day so that justice might be done. The recent Pizzagate revelations are just the tip of a massive iceberg. Watch The Big Picture, Pizzagate and Beyond. Learn the terrifying truth at beyondpizzagate.com.
Leave them kids alone.
All right, guys, welcome back. So anyway, the official claim in the Not-So-Holy Book is that Solomon had married an Egyptian queen, right? Well, guess what? If we interpret King Solomon to have been, a local tribal chieftain there in ancient Palestine, that's just not true. In fact, according to Kadesh Enlil I of Babylon, Amenhotep III, whom we're talking about right now specifically, right, the real King Solomon, Amenhotep III told him, quote, "From of old, a daughter of the king of the land of Egypt was not given to anyone." So it was Egyptian custom to not marry out a royal princess to a foreign dignitary. Many other ancient cultures did do that, and our little tribal friends had certainly cornered the market on that. That's how they got their sleazy foot in the door, right, with many royal courts. But the Egyptians did not do that. So when we're told that Solomon married an Egyptian woman, that's true once we understand who the real Solomon was. Amenhotep married an Egyptian woman, but not a tribal king in the Middle East, in ancient Palestine. No, absolutely not. So there's another lie in the Not-So-Holy Book. Again, it's a lie if you interpret it the way it's stated. It's not a lie when you understand how to interpret it and you know who the real King Solomon was. Anyway, according to Herodotus, Cambyses of Persia attacked Egypt because Pharaoh Amasis refused to give his daughter to him. That's how opposed the ancient Egyptians were to marrying out the royalty, to marrying out their daughters. Again, an absolute impossibility. Again, but Bible dupes, never look into this. They never look into the historicity of anything. They just accept what that detestably lying book says. Just like, I was a big fan of Daniel, the prophet Daniel in the Old Testament. So much so that my poor kid, I actually named him Daniel after, it's not a bad name, but I had a bad excuse for doing it, right? He was my favorite because I thought he was a man of integrity. He stood up against, the popular sway of his day and stood up for, quote, truth. Yeah, whatever. But in any case. Having been a big fan of Daniel, and I bought hook, line, and sinker the whole Daniel story, little did I know that there's no historical legitimacy to that entire story. For example, we're told in that book that King Nebuchadnezzar, upon his death, handed over the reins of power to his son Belshazzar, right? And then Belshazzar became king immediately after his father Nebuchadnezzar. That whole story is bullshit. Belshazzar came around like four generations after Nebuchadnezzar. It's an incontestable fact. We now know that from archaeological digs. Belshazzar was not. How did this come about? I'll tell you how it came about. In ancient times, and even in modern times, sometimes we do this. If your great-great-great-great-great-grandfather was somebody famous, you might refer to yourself as being his child and or him being your father, meaning your forefather, right? That was much more common in ancient times. For example, Jesus is called the son of David, right? But we know that Jesus lived centuries after the time of David, regardless who you interpret David to have been, whether you believe that he was a local tribal chieftain in the Middle East or whether you understand him to have been the Hyksosian pharaoh of Thutmose III. It doesn't matter. Centuries went by between that time and the time of Christ, and yet Christ is called the son of David. He obviously was not the literal son, right? Well, the same here with Nebuchadnezzar and Belshazzar. Belshazzar, whoever wrote the book of Daniel, probably came across a document that referred to Belshazzar as the son of Nebuchadnezzar. And that was true. He was related to him, removed by, four or five generations, though. But they didn't know that. They just assumed it meant literal son. I'm glad they didn't know that, because that's another way we can prove that that book is full of shit. Absolutely unreliable. Completely unreliable. course, you know, that's one of many, many, many historical inconsistencies that I mention in my book. Anybody that doesn't have that, if you want, again, just drop me an email. I'll send it to you. I now have that book significantly added to. So I don't know when that's going to be. I got some projects, but when that's ready, I'll let you know. I'm going to, this time I'm going to have it professionally edited, and I'm going to make it available on, you know, in an electronic version. So it'll be more affordable. Because the printed version is just, yeah, it's through the roof. And especially this one now is going to be even bigger, so naturally it's going to come with a bigger price tag as far as the printed version goes. So I'm going to make sure it's available electronically, so it'll be much more affordable. But yeah, I've added probably at least 100 more pages now. As of the other day, interestingly enough, it was up to 666 pages, believe it or not. I didn't plan it that way. That's just how it worked. But now I'm beyond that. Now I'm like 672 or something like that. I don't want to add too much more, but what I did add since sending it to the printer last fall or whatever it was, is very significant. Stuff that, you know, I wish I had included with the first printing. But in any case, this next printing is going to be much, much, much better. I've added a lot more significant stuff that I just overlooked, you know, as I went through it and I'm editing, ideas came to my mind and I'm like, oh my God, don't tell me I didn't mention that in here. And sure enough, wow, I didn't include that. It's amazing. You know, you think you're all inclusive as you're writing it, but then you realize later, wow, how the hell did I forget that? Not only that, but there's some new things that I stumbled on that I wasn't even aware of before. Like, you know, statements from some apocryphal books that precisely parallel statements in both the Old and New Testament, showing that there was more plagiarism, because these apocryphal books preceded the authorship of certainly in the New Testament. So when you see plagiarized statements in the New Testament from books that long, you know, by centuries had preceded the New Testament, you know, you got plagiarism. But you know what's sad, guys, as you point this out to Bible believers, and I'm sure many of you have experienced this, you know what they say, right? Well, that was the devil copying stuff in advance. Oh, my God, is it pathetic, man. You see the stuff they resort to because they just can't admit that there's problems in their book? They can't even admit one, even though there's thousands of them. They can't even admit one because they know if they do that, the whole thing's going to crumble, right? The Bible is supposed to contain one problem, one mistake, one error, one contradiction. It's loaded with them. If you haven't ever dealt with Bible dupes over issues like this, you got to experience it at least once so you see what I'm talking about. The mental disconnect, the cognitive dissonance, guys, you won't encounter the likes of this with pretty much any other subject, unless you talk to people about, you know, the government being corrupt. You'll see the same thing there, but not with such vigilance as you will with religious people. Because, you know, religious people are much more attached to their religion than people out of their government, for the most part, anyway. And so you'll see this displayed on a scale like you won't see anywhere else. It's unbelievable. You'll show them immoral statements that Yahweh made, immoral things that Yahweh did, and they'll come up with excuses for that. They would admit that, you know, things like that said or done by anybody else are horrible, right? But when when they see it's him saying it or doing it, oh well, that's because, you know, and then they'll go off into this horseshit, excuse making diatribe. So disgusting. They just can't. They literally can't. Their own mind will not allow them. The mental enslavement that goes on there, it just boggles my mind. But anyways, all right, let's get back to my notes. Amenhotep III was able to receive foreign princesses as his wives because he paid out gold for them. Remember that Solomon is said to have done, he's said to have been in possession of, you know, great great hoards of gold, right? We're told about this tremendous wealth. Where would he have gotten this? Now, we know the tribe has a real knack for stealing all the time, don't they? But there's no evidence that any local tribal chieftain in ancient Palestine had a great kingdom or a tremendous amount of gold. But there was a tribal, i.e. Hyksos king, that did have a tremendous amount of gold and did have a lot of wives and concubines in Egypt. So again, we can see now who it's really talking about. This, quote, Solomon that had great riches was an Egyptian king, and he got his great riches because, having stolen the throne, he claimed all of that as his own. Like everything else they get, guys, they steal it, don't they? They always have, they always will, they still are now. Nothing different. Different place, different names, but same game, right? As always. Just look at one Babylonian king, what one Babylonian king had to say to Amenhotep III, or you know, Solomon, in this very regard, as recorded in the Amarna letters. Check this out. Here's what this Babylonian king had to say. Now, as for the gold about which I wrote you, send very much gold, as much as possible. He's requesting gold from the king, right? Send it now and quickly, even before your return messenger reaches me, that I may carry through the work that I have undertaken. At this point, Babylon was being threatened by some local kingdoms, and Babylon at this time was a protectorate, you know, an Egyptian protectorate. So he's asking Pharaoh, look, I need plenty of gold so I can, you know, buy defenses here, buy some mercenary soldiers, buy some weapons, you know, blah, blah, blah. Send this to me as quick as you can. He knew that this Pharaoh had lots of gold, right? He went on to say, if during the harvest you send the gold for which I sent or requested, then I will give you my daughter. Ah, so not only does this passage confirm that Amenhotep III did have a lot of gold, right? Like we're told Solomon did, but it confirms that this Pharaoh was looking for outside wives, just as we're told the great Solomon had done. How do you like that, guys? Look at these parallels. Fortunately, we have these Amarna letters that have helped to fill in a lot of gaps. And of all times in Egyptian history, to have letters like this survive to our day, this was the most important time that you would want letters like that to survive, because this is... this was during a Hyksosian occupation. Not the main one, but one that most scholars don't recognize. But you can recognize it once you know what clues to look for. This was the third, actually, as it turns out, the third Hyksosian occupation, which continued, like I said, up until the time of Tut. Another king, known as Tushratta, he was a king of Mitanni, wrote thusly to Amenhotep III, or Solomon, asking for gold in return for his daughter's hand in marriage, just like the Babylonian king we just read about. He said, let my brother, meaning Amenhotep III, let my brother send me exceeding much gold. So in this case, the gold was just apparently a dowry that he was supposed to be paying him. Didn't have anything to do with him, you know, fighting a war. Send me this gold without measure, for in my brother's land, gold is as plentiful as dust. In other words, I know you got plenty of gold, so don't hold back. Give me lots of gold, and I'll give you my daughter. So here we have two kings now that were sending their daughter in exchange for gold. How pathetic, guys. But in typical tribal fashion, Amenhotep III did not fully come through with his promise. So Tushratta later wrote to the queen, his wife, Taiyi, saying, quote, you did not send all of my greeting gift that your husband ordered, you know, to be sent. I had asked him for statues of solid cast gold, saying, may my brother, again the king, send me as a greeting gift statues of solid cast gold and genuine lapis lazuli. What did he get? Gold-plated statues, very thinly plated gold. He did not get the gold that he was promised. How tribal of Amenhotep III. Not only did he not send all the promised gold, but he apparently sent counterfeit lapis lazuli as well. This sounds like the shafting job that Solomon is said to have given to King Hiram of Tyre. Remember that story? I won't read it now. I've read it many times in the past, but if you want to look it up, it's in 1 Kings 9, verses 10 to 13. Here we have the story of King Hiram helping, you know, quote, King Solomon, nod, nod, wink, wink, helping him to build the temple. He provided him with men, you know, labor. He provided him with gold because the Phoenicians were great traders, right? He provided him with wood, you name it. And then later, in thankfulness for all the help that Tyre gave him, we're told that Solomon stiffed him and gave him, I think it was 7 cities that were worthless. They were like ghost towns. There was nothing about them that had any value. And so in this passage in 1 Kings, you've got, you know, King Hiram asking Solomon, what have you done, my brother? What's going on here? You promised me, you know, to reward me great gifts, and now you've given me these worthless cities. Yes. So now we see that Amenhotep III, who we know was the real King David, King Solomon, we're seeing that he did essentially the same thing, right? Stiffing these kings of the gold that he promised them. So, you know, the gifts are different, right? We would expect that. The Bible always changes some of the details, but the principle is the same. Both of these kings were lying traitors, lying scam artists. So Mr. Amenhotep III is exactly like the biblical Solomon, isn't he? Of course he is. Look at these parallels. Another parallel to this exists in the Amount of Letters, where King Abimlechi of Tyre, in letter number 99, asked Amenhotep III to, quote, give the city of Huzu to his servant, meaning himself, you know, give it to me, your servant. And it never happened. Solomon stiffed him. So now we see another parallel with the biblical story of not coming through with, again, it's only one city here instead of 7 in the biblical account. But it doesn't matter. It's the same idea, isn't it? We now see that Amenhotep III, nod, nod, wink, wink, Solomon, stiffed people with gold and stiffed them you know, promising to give cities to dignitaries, just like, exactly like the Bible said. And so here's what letter 29 says. The same king indicated that another city had been placed under his control by Amenhotep. He said, and now the city Zarbitu is to be guarded by the city of Tyre for the Egyptian king, my lord. So there you go. He didn't come through with his promise. Anyway, coming back to Amenhotep's monopoly on gold, this is exactly what gave Amenhotep III, or, quote, Solomon, his political edge, control of the gold market. Now, how familiar does that sound? Where have we seen that before? His real source of power and influence in the world was gold. He is said to have created a great empire, ladies and gentlemen. That, you know, when you talk about the glory days of the ancient Egyptian empire, you're talking about Amenhotep III. Now, isn't it interesting that in the biblical account, we're told that Solomon had a great empire. We know that there was no great empire run out of ancient Palestine. That's a freaking established, irrefutable fact. But we do know that the Egyptian pharaoh Menetep III had a great empire. And we do know now, don't we, that he was a Hyksos. So there you go. There's your Solomonic Empire right there for you, folks. Once again, let me remind you, why is Freemasonry so fascinated with ancient Egypt and with Solomon particularly? Because he was the man through whom they had their first real go at world domination. And so their aim is to revive that, to bring it back. That's why Freemasonry has the Solomonic and, quote, Egyptian iconography that they do. They're hearkening back to those glory days that they want to resurrect. End of story. Oh, guys, it took me a while to finally put these pieces together. I don't know why. It should have been in my face. But having put it together, boy, does history come to life now. Things really, really make sense now. With this understanding, you can finally put the pieces together. It was so confusing to me for the longest time. Why? What the hell does ancient Egypt have to do with King Solomon? You know, I puzzled over that for the longest time. When all the while the answers were there for the taking, it just, you know, why? In any case, everything in its right time, right? Maybe I wasn't ready because I didn't have certain other pieces of background information that I now have. Now, having discovered this, you know, I'm able to put the pieces together better, I guess. But at the same time, I feel like I should have stumbled on this a long time ago. Damn it. It makes so much sense now. But, you know, like I said, I needed to study the ancient Hyksos and figure out exactly who they were. I remember hearing about the Hyksos back in high school and then, you know, later in college. And it's one of those things that just kind of went in one ear and out the other. Okay, yeah, Hyksos, yeah, whatever. Yeah, they occupied Egypt. Yeah, okay, whatever, fine. The way they present it, it doesn't seem that significant. And it seems like, well, it was just such a short time. It really didn't matter. And who cares who they were? It doesn't affect us today, right? You know, that's the attitude that many people have. They present it in such a boring way and in such a disjointed fashion, not making any connections with anything that we can relate to, that of course you're going to brush it over and, you know, history is going to be, for the most part, boring. I was fascinated with ancient history, but I just didn't think it had any correlations with anything going on today. You know what I'm saying? Because they present it that way. They don't want you to make any connections. Once you see those connections, though, wow, it just takes on a whole new meaning. And you are compelled to want to dig into history more. You're foolish not to. It's really the only way to put into, you know, proper perspective what the hell's going on right now. Anyway, as the protocols state, I got to read this quote now because it's so fitting to you know, fits in so well with what we're talking about right now. In our day, it says, the power which has replaced that of the rulers is the power of gold. Whether a state exhausts itself in its own convulsions, whether its internal discord brings it under the power of external foes, in any case, it can be accounted irretrievably lost if it is in our power. The despotism of capital, which is entirely in our hands, reaches out to a straw that the state must take hold of. If not, it goes to the bottom. And how true that is today, guys. Look at, you know, NAFTA, GATT before that, and now the WTO. Look at the power they have to bend nations to their will. Not that they even need to do that, because most of the world leaders are, you know, freaking circle jerk buddies of theirs. But that, you know, to make it look good for the general masses, right? They can justify it by saying, well, we need to change our policies and go along with what the international corporations want to some degree, because if not, quote, we'll go to the bottom. In so many words, we've heard that from Washington, haven't we? to justify, you know, the power that the WTO has to bend. Anyway, my point is, this is an old game of theirs. It's nothing new. Not only is it in the protocols, guys, we can go back to the time of Amenhotep III and see that that's how he gained his power. That's what gave him his edge. You just read, or you just heard me read, from those two, or was it three? Three Amarna letters, where these kings are licking this guy's hind parts to get gold from him, which he didn't even come through on. But nevertheless, isn't it pathetic that these ancient kings were eating out of this guy's hand to get his little handouts? Oh, do they love that power. Do they love it, guys? Here we are thousands of years later, and this horseshit is still going on. Even if we had leaders that weren't already, you know, part of their tribe and licking their ass to begin with, unfortunately, guys, unless we had some, you know, real men in office, which we don't, unfortunately, guys, they'd be doing the same thing for the most part. They'd be licking their ass too, just like the three kings we were just reading. So disgusting. People don't, not only don't have any testicular fortitude anymore, people don't even have any scruples to stand up against this crap. Like money is the all that ends all. It is, unfortunately, in our world today because of the way people view it, but it isn't in reality. It isn't. It certainly should not be. Fuck money. I absolutely can't stand the whole concept of it, guys. It's ruined our world. It's not a means of commerce and exchange. It's a means of fucking control. That's all it is. And every friggin' country they pissed on, that's what they've always turned it into, a means of control and enslavement, driving people into desperation, driving them into the streets because they can't even afford the fucking house that they already paid 4 years ago. They can't afford to keep it going anymore. Today, you can't even afford to buy a house anymore. But even if you could or did years ago, many people have been losing their homes because they can't afford the goddamn taxes. Look at the power that this shit called money gives them, guys. Oh, that we would scrap it and return to a bartering system. All right, sure, break bread for that.
Labeled an evil Nazi? Embarrassed at being associated with the homo alt-right? At 25andhigh.com, we have a millennia of experience in changing names, all within our laws. Why be a Woodley when you can change to Weinstein and openly get away with sexually assaulting women and children? Scared of being a Gershom? Well, change to Greenspan, you schmuck. Print paper money out of thin air, charge interest, bam, set for life. How about Smith to Spectre and call for the genocide of an entire race? It's so simple. And a 25 Bitcoin transfer from you guarantees a new, clean Jewish identity. No more shame, guilt, or white privilege anxiety. 25andhigh.com. Be the changer you want to see.
You're listening to Renegade Broadcasting.
Guys, welcome back. Anyway, the tremendous amount of gold that Solomon had, the monopoly that he had on gold, is much like what is described about Solomon, again, in the Bible. Let's take a look at 1 Kings 10:23. It says, King Solomon was greater in riches than all the other kings of the earth. Could that ever have been said about any local tribal chieftain in ancient Palestine? No. I mean, seriously, any other king on earth? More gold there? Well, how ridiculous. But it can be said about Mr. Amenhotep III. He did have, you just saw some letters written by kings of his day where they're begging and pleading with him to send some gold. And as much as he had, the little bastard didn't send them anything or sent them gold-plated crap. They said that gold in your land is as plentiful as dust. Remember that? And where did they get all their gold? They stole it. But nevertheless, they had plenty, right? So this passage here, 1 Kings 10:23, is not true of any local tribal chieftain in ancient Palestine, but it is true of this character, isn't it? Likewise, Yahweh is said to have told Solomon in 1 Kings 3:13, I will give you both wealth and honor so that in your lifetime you will have no equal among kings. No equal among kings. Because why? Because he'll have so much gold, right? That's not true of any ancient Palestinian chieftain, but it is true of Amenhotep III. Interestingly enough, Solomon is said to have taken in 666 talents of gold annually, as recorded in 1 Kings 10:14. 666? Now, isn't that interesting? You know, it's the only other place in the entire Bible where that number is recorded. The other place, of course, is Revelation 13, 18, you know, the number of the beast. The only other place you find that, other than Revelation, is right here in reference to King Solomon. How come no Bible dupe has any problem with that? Why don't they question that? Wait a minute, that's supposed to be an evil number, the mark of the beast, right? Why is that number used in association with Mr. Solomon? Why is that? Very troubling indeed. A moment ago, we cited a letter from Tushratta, you know, the Mitanni king, written to Amenhotep III, where he said that gold in Egypt was as plentiful as dust, right? With this in mind, notice what we read in 2 Chronicles 1:15, Old Testament passage here. The king, meaning Solomon, made silver and gold as common in Jerusalem as stones. Isn't that interesting? Isn't that interesting? Do you see the plagiarism going on here and the misapplication of the real story of Amenhotep III to a supposed local tribal chieftain in ancient Palestine? It's bullshit, guys. All of these details do apply to someone in the ancient world, but not to anybody the Bible's trying to get you to focus on. No. These stories do have an element of truth to them, but once again, not if you read them as they're stated. The truth emerges when you lift up the veil and realize that all they're doing is creating a diversion, an illusion, that they had a great kingdom there in ancient Palestine. They didn't. They didn't. Their great kingdom was their hijacking of Egypt. They don't want you to know about that, though. Let's look at another interesting parallel here. Amenhotep III conducted extensive gold mining operations in a land called Timnah, which was in the Negev Desert. And traditionally, this area was known, interestingly enough, as even to this day, that area is known as Solomon's Mines. Now, I believe he got his gold from other places, too. But it's just interesting that this area, Timnah, to this day, is called, this area is called Solomon's Mines, because they know a lot of ancient gold was mined from there. But again, guys, they want you to think it was, quote, Solomon. It wasn't. It was Amenhotep III. Also found in this area were many precious stones, all of which were used in the decoration of Amenhotep's temples. And Solomon likewise is said to have had thusly decorated his temple. 2 Chronicles 3, verse 6, for example, says, he, Solomon, adorned the temple with precious stones, and the gold he used was gold of Parvaim, which must be a reference to Timnah in this instance anyway. But notice, they both used a lot of precious stones and a lot of gold in their temples. So Solomon's temple, nod, nod, wink, wink, was in fact built in Egypt. There was a temple built later. In fact, it probably was Amenhotep III who built it there on behalf of his tribe, many of which had migrated there because they were thrown out during the Hyksosian expulsion, right? Generations earlier. So he did build them a temple there, you know, for their use there. But the original, the glamorous, glorious temple decked with gold and precious stones, that was in Egypt, not in Jerusalem. Anyway, but there was a temple in Jerusalem. I want to make that clear. I talked about this before, and it wasn't on the Temple Mount. Some of you will recall I did a show on that. It was about a quarter of a mile south of there, and it certainly was not glamorous, you know, like the Amenhotep III temple. But there was a temple there. They did offer sacrifice. You can see the holes in the floor where the animals were shackled, you know, for sacrifice. You can see drainage system where the water that brought up from the Gihon spring would wash the blood away, on and on. Gold, in fact, overlaid just about everything, we're told, in Solomon's temple. In 1 Kings 6:21, it says, Solomon covered the inside of the temple with pure gold, and he extended gold chains across the front of the inner sanctuary, which was overlaid with gold. So gold, gold, gold galore. Once again, was there a chieftain in the Middle East that had, you know, this kind of gold? No. No. Absolutely not. But there was an Egyptian pharaoh who had established an empire and was receiving tribute from all of his underlings, you know, as described in the Old Testament. But again, this king was in Egypt. Likewise, at his Luxor temple on a stela at the rear of this temple is this inscription, folks. This is an Amenhotep III inscription. It reads, behold, the heart of his majesty was satisfied with making a very great monument. Never has happened the like since the beginning. Do you see the parallel here? We were just told, oh, there's never been a king like unto him so glamorous with so much wealth. Now we're seeing the same thing said in this Egyptian relief here about Amenhotep III. It goes on to say, he made it as his monument for his father, Amun, meaning the god Amun. An august temple, an external everlasting fortress of fine white sandstone wrought with gold throughout. Its floor is adorned with silver and its portals with electrum. It is made very wide and large and established forever. So the same glorious description we have of, quote, Solomon's temple in the Old Testament is what we're given here about Amenhotep the Third's temple. These parallels, guys, they just go on and on. They're nonstop. Amenhotep III also built a mortuary temple in western Thebes. It was oriented toward the east and had two colossi of Memnon placed at the entrance, akin to the biblical reference to the two pillars at the entrance of Solomon's temple. Do you see the connections here? And by the way, the fact that this temple was facing toward the east, you know, as a sun worshiper, that was done, you know, to greet the rising sun. You do know, guys, that all of the Catholic cathedrals, I don't know if they still do this with local churches now, but historically, all Catholic cathedrals across Europe were constructed that same way, facing the east. And let me remind you, the Catholic religion is absolutely overflowing with solar imagery. You got the halos behind the heads of the saints. That stands for the solar disk. You've got the old monstrances they used to use, that they would put the round wafer for the communion service. That round wafer represents the sun. They would stick it in the center of this monstrance that had brass, brightly shining yellow brassy, you know, metal rays coming out, spraying out in every direction like the sun's rays, right? And you look at it, and it's obviously a sun. All of this solar imagery, where does this come from? It's a reflection going back, guys, to the Hyksosian domination of Egypt and the worship of the Aten. Amun-Ra at first, and then later the Hyksos adopted the Aten, and that's where you get, you know, what's his name? Akhenaten, you know, pushing his Atenism, which really is Adonai, don't forget. Aten and Adonai is one and the same. And, you know, pushing so much that was to be the only god worshipped, right? Doesn't that sound familiar? Our next and final installment in this particular, well, main installment. I got a couple other little tag-alongs I'm probably going to cover after that. But the next show I'm going to be talking about, the next topic, I should say, is going to be dealing with Akhenaten. I've already talked about Akhenaten before, but not quite from this perspective, certainly not revealing him to have been the biblical Moses. No question about it. Now, let me say this quick before I go on. Biblically speaking, if you look at the chronology in the Old Testament, Moses preceded David and Solomon, right? And so you might be wondering, well, how can it be that if Akhenaten is Moses, why does he follow the pharaohs that match up with David and Solomon? Because the biblical chronology is horseshit. That's why. End of story. It doesn't have to coincide with the biblical chronology. It's all crap. The important thing is that the character of Akhenaten, who was definitely a Hyksos, precisely matches up with Moses. We don't have to worry about biblical chronology. Screw that. I was just talking a little while ago about how chronology in Daniel is all screwed up, right? With Nebuchadnezzar and his so-called son Belshazzar, when in fact Belshazzar was a freaking great grandson, for God's sake. So we don't have to worry about lining up with biblical chronology. Once you realize that's all crap, you don't have to be constrained by it anymore. Anyway, moving on. All the temples built by Amenhotep III, and indeed all Egyptian temples in general, had two main compartments, just like we're told about Solomon's temple. There was the forecourt and reception area, you know, for public gatherings. And then there was an inner court, or Holy of Holies, where the chief deity was said to reside, right? And where only the priest was allowed to enter. So the same basic setup with Egyptian temples, or should I say Hyksosian-built Egyptian temples, is what we have in the Old Testament's description of the Temple of Solomon. Same thing, guys. Built the same way. And I always used to argue that, well, that's because, you know, the authors of the Old Testament were just plagiarizing from ancient Egypt. Well, in a lot of ways, that is true. They did plagiarize a lot from ancient Egypt. But now we can understand exactly how this plagiarism came about. Because all they were doing in the Old Testament is describing something that actually did exist, but not in, once again, ancient Palestine. These things did exist, as described, but in Egypt. So they really weren't plagiarizing Egypt in that sense. They were describing something that actually did exist in Egypt. But you see my point. They weren't so much borrowing from Egypt in their description of the temple. They were describing an actual temple that did exist in Egypt and just lying about where it actually was. As far as this glorious temple decked with so much gold and precious stones, the one built in Jerusalem was a piece of junk compared to the one that was in Egypt. Although, you know, the second temple, oh yeah, when they were sucking off of Rome, that was elaborately decked, yes. Anyway, in one temple scene, Amenhotep III is actually depicted as seated in the Ark of the Sun God, thus identifying himself as this god while he was still alive. This was something unique with the Hyksosian pharaohs, guys, where they claimed to be the very god that they were compelling others to worship. Same with Moses. Akhenaten. He did the same thing, guys. He identified himself as the Aten himself. Not just the son of Aten, but the human incarnation of Aten. Now, isn't that interesting? Because what are we told about the great Jesus? Is Jesus not said to have been the incarnation of God? Do you see where this crap comes from? No wonder he's called the son of David. Who was David? David was Thutmose III, the Hyksosian king. He also claimed to be a human incarnation of God. So the many authors over the years that have talked about how the Bible plagiarizes from ancient Egypt, they're right, yes, but how did that plagiarism come about? Now we have our answer, don't we? Egyptian kings were said to become a god after death in general. But here was Amenhotep III and some other Hyksosian kings like him portraying themselves as such while still alive. That's the difference. Yes, pretty much all Egyptian pharaohs claimed to become God after death, right? And that's true with other cultures too. You know, ancient Babylonian kings, the Sumerian kings, they claimed the same thing, that after death, you know, for example, Nimrod claimed to be, to become the sun god after he died. His soul or spirit or whatever, you know, was absorbed by the sun. And then his wife Semiramis claimed to have become impregnated by the sun's rays, i.e. her husband, after he was dead. And so her son now became not only the heir to the throne, but he was the son of God. Yes, Nimrod was a son of God, impregnated supposedly divinely by the rays of the sun, being, you know, Nimrod in the sun, right? look at the parallels once again with Christianity, guys. What do you think that whole shit, frickin' fuck story came from? Anyway. No other pharaoh, though, dared to claim to be a god while still alive, guys. Look at the arrogance here. And let's not forget, in the Middle Ages, what did they do? The royal bloodlines. And we know who they were, right? They talked about the divine right of kings so that everybody would respect the king as though God was divinely leading him. In a sense, they were making the king God once again, weren't they? Their king, with part of their bloodline. The same idea. They did it in China too, right? The divine mandate, or the mandate of heaven, they called it. Mandate of heaven. Same shit. Same shit. That you needed to obey the king, even when he screwed up, because it's God commanding him. So don't get mad with him when he screws up, because it's God commanding. Are you fucking kidding me? You don't think that came from the same source? You bet your sweet ass it did. They got a problem now, though, because they've been wanting to move people away from religion. That's been the aim of our Judeo-Masonic buddies, right? Because they wanted to reduce the power of the church. But now they realize, shit, this worked so well for us in the past. How do we get people back to that when we've got so many people now turning to atheism? And they want a world religion, at least initially anyway, because they know that's a great unifying factor and it's a powerful deception tool. So you see how the things work against them very often. It's almost humorous if it wasn't so fucking pathetic. It's almost humorous to sit back and watch how what they're pushing today becomes a problem for them tomorrow, and they try to backstep to reverse it. Oh, my God, man. It's unbelievable. Anyway, but you know, you think that would alert people, and they'd realize, you know, I need to scrap everything I've been told, everything, because it's all horse shit, right? No. Been watching a lot of interesting videos on, you know, cognitive dissonance and how the brain works. And it's so true, guys. And they've got this thing long ago figured out and mastered. They know how the mind works. They know how to sucker the masses into believing horse shit. Oh, yeah, they know there's going to be a few stragglers here and there. There's always a few that will never buy into it. But that doesn't matter to them as long as the bulk of the population falls for their horse shit. And they do every time. Once they get the idea in your head that this certain truth is unquestionable and it's firmly established, what they call truth. Once they get that idea, be it political, religious, doesn't matter. Once they get that in your head, they don't have to do any more work because your own brain will do it for them. Your own brain will censor any other information that comes along that doesn't coincide with the horseshit that they were sold years or decades ago. Almost every time, that will work for a lifetime. Is that fucked up or what? Even though I fell for a lot of that shit myself years ago, I'm so glad, guys. I don't know what the hell the reason is, but I'm so glad. Even though it took me a while, a lot longer than I care to mention, I'm glad that eventually I did come out of my frickin' slumber and finally smell the roses. I've scrapped pretty much everything that I was told since I was a kid, because I've realized it's all a bunch of horse shit. And it all kept me under their thumb. Not only collectively, but even as I began to wake up with some of the issues, I began to realize as the years went on and I started uncovering more shit and more shit, I realized that even though I was awake to some degree, the shit that I was still believing still kept me under their thumb. That's why you just can't go part of the way. I've said this many times before. I'll say it again. You can't go part of the way with the truth. You've got to go all the way. All the way, baby. All the way. Which is why I get so goddamnably frustrated when I see Bible dupes claiming to be Jew wise and still clinging to that horse shit. Oh, my God. Seriously? No. You don't get it as long as you fall for that book. Sorry, you're in the wrong ballpark. Never mind the parking lot of the ballpark. You're not even within 100 miles of the ballpark. If you're falling for that bullshit book, that is their number one deception tool down to the centuries. And to a large extent, it still is today. if you're falling for that, then you need to go back to kindergarten and start all over. Seriously, seriously. I remember people telling me years ago, "Oh, you're being divisive. You're going to prevent us from uniting people, in the truth." Oh, no, 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 no. Stop right there. They're divisive, not me. With their bullshit religion, they're the ones that are divisive. They're the ones that say, unless you come over to my side and swallow my horse shit, you're not saved. You're a sinner. You're going to hell. You're not going to heaven like me. You call that a uniting factor? Do you even want to be united under those kind of fucking terms? What a crock of horseshit. Who's being divisive? Guess again. Anyway. Oh, I got a lot more to say about that book, believe me. When I look at the shows that I've been putting together that I haven't aired yet, they actually outnumber the ones I've already aired. But, I could go for the next 6 years, especially one show a week, just talking about that fucking book. It's stuff I haven't even covered yet. I won't do that to you, but I will be getting back to that topic, once I finish this Egyptian stuff. Oh, boy, do I got a lot more to say about that. It's endless, guys. It's a bottomless pit. That book is so full of shit, man. You can't even cover it all in a lifetime. Anyway, in recent years, carvings have been found that depict Amenhotep as having worshipped his own self, guys. Can you believe it? Now, who would do something like that? What group of people do we know of that have this habit of self-worship? They worship themselves, and they want you to worship them too. Can you guess? When I read that, I'm like, oh, shit, stop the presses. I knew I had to put that in this set of notes. I'm so glad I stumbled upon that interesting factoid quite by accident before I broadcast this show. This show will be totally complete without the show. All right, guys, so thanks for that.
Herbs have been used by people since the dawn of time. When Rockefeller introduced allopathic medicine, many herbal remedies fell by the wayside as people put their faith in prescription pills and the world just gets sicker. Here at Heathen Herbs, we look to the past and to nature for answers. We offer tinctures, magnesium skin cream, lip balm, tooth powder, colloidal silver throat spray, and more. Check us out at heathenherbs.com.
All right, guys, welcome back. Amenhotep III was dubbed in Egypt as, quote, the shining solar disk of all the land. Wow, look at the arrogance, drawing attention to himself. Look at me! No wonder he was named by the tribe Solomon. Sol, of course, is the word for the sun, and On was the ancient Egyptian city of Heliopolis, the city of the sun. And who was the sun king, ladies and gentlemen? Amenhotep III, the real Solomon. The fact that Amenhotep III portrayed himself as a god, again, reminds us, guys, of, you know, this medieval concept, divine right of kings. Look how they keep repeating the same shit everywhere they go, even though it's centuries, even millennia later, the same game. You can tell it's the same people. Their fingerprints, their shit, freaking ass picking, shit stained fingerprints show up everywhere they go, don't they? Let's look at some interesting Solomon Egypt connections in the Bible. Well, we've already looked at a few, but let's look at some more in the Bible here. Regarding the alliances that Amenhotep III gained through marrying, you know, foreign princesses. And notice the hypocrisy, guys. This Hyksosian king, even though, you know, that was Egyptian custom already, but he followed through with it himself, right? He wouldn't marry his daughters out, but yet he wanted other kings and did, in fact, get other kings to marry their daughters out to him so that he would get his foot in the door with them. And he'd make all these grandiose promises. I'm going to send you gold. He reneged on him, but not before, you know, it was too late when they already made agreements and sold their daughters to him. You see what was going on here. They got their daughters for free, and now that already gave them a foot in the door. Hey, why should I pay him gold? I already got the daughter. You see my point. Look what was going on. This is as sleazy as you can possibly get. Who else is capable of doing something like this? Who else has done stuff like this down through the centuries over and over again? Anyway. So the Bible talks about Solomon having done this very same thing, right? You know, intermarrying with princesses from all different lands. Again, we have no evidence of any tribal chieftain having done this, certainly not on a grand scale, in ancient Palestine. But we do know that Amenhotep III did this, which matches up with all these other parallels we're looking at. While this confirms the Solomon-Egypt connection, it was actually intended to hide the fact that Solomon was actually headquartered in Egypt rather than in Jerusalem. 1 Kings 3:1 says, and Solomon became allied to Pharaoh, king of Egypt. You see how they want to make it look like Solomon was located outside of Egypt and that he was allied with the Pharaoh? No, he was the Pharaoh. He was allied to the king of Egypt by marriage. Well, that's not entirely a lie, is it? The entire Hyksosian tribe became allied to Egypt. Yay, they hijacked Egypt. How? Through marriage. Initially by Abraham pimping out his wife, but later on, through marriage. Yes, that's how they did it. And as a matter of fact, Abraham's wife did marry the Pharaoh. Remember that story, right? Not knowing that it was Abraham's wife. The passage goes on, and took Pharaoh's daughter. We're supposed to believe that Pharaoh is going to send his daughter. No Egyptian Pharaoh ever did this. Remember, we just read the quotes a little while ago. But yet this lying piece of shit, so-called holy book, would have us believe that Pharaoh sent one of his daughters out to marry this insignificant, you know, sheep peddling frickin' tribal chieftain is going to send his daughter out. They didn't send their daughters out at all, even to much more elaborate, you know, powerful kings. But we're supposed to believe that the Pharaoh was going to say, this is ridiculous, guys. But, well, as it turns out, this particular pharaoh was a Hyksosian pharaoh. So he probably did send some of his daughters, you know, to ancient Palestine, because that's where their tribe had located, right? Relocated, or, you know, after being kicked out of Egypt. So there probably is a little truth to that. But again, that was not custom. No pharaoh would send his daughter out to any foreign kingdom unless that kingdom was part of the pharaoh's bloodline. He had made an end, it says, of building his own house and the house of the Lord and the wall of Jerusalem round about. This is talking supposedly about Solomon. In truth, Amenhotep III first married Tyi, as stated before, that was his first wife, his royal wife, who was actually the daughter of a Hyksosian court advisor, Yuya, who many believe, by the way, was the biblical Joseph. There's a lot of evidence for that, but, you know, I think that the Joseph character was borrowed from a couple different individuals, both of which were Hyksosian, you know, court advisors. Anyway, there's other interesting Egyptian connections made with Solomon in the Old Testament. For instance, in, where is the 2 Chronicles 9:28, we read this, and they were bringing horses for Solomon from Egypt and from all countries. So here Solomon had lots of horses that came from all countries. Here's another passage like this, 2 Chronicles 1, 16 and 17 says, and Solomon's horses were imported from Egypt and from Ku. The king's traders procured them from Ku for a price. So we're told here that Solomon had lots of horses, right? Do we have evidence of lots of horses in early Palestine? No, not really. Horses that traveled through, but not, you know, large numbers. It was mostly a sheep herding community, right? And thus, the Hyksos themselves were originally known as shepherd kings. So no, there weren't a lot of horses being raised there. There were a lot of horses in ancient Egypt, though. We're told about chariots. Solomon having lots of chariots. Regarding chariots, note the following fascinating quote. This is from Ariel Kosloff in Amenhotep III, Egypt's Radiant Pharaoh. It says, it is astonishing to think that horses and their obvious pendant, the chariot, were completely unknown in Egypt for the first 1,500 years or so of its written history until the Hyksos invasion. Dynasty 18 pharaohs quickly came up to speed in horsemanship, including breeding, husbandry, training, and driving. By Amenhotep III's time, that's our little buddy Solomon, right? Egypt regularly imported fine horses from the Near East and had also developed breeding programs of his own. Where did these horses come from? They were imported by who? Well, our little Phoenician buddies, right, that we know the tribe was hooked up with. That's where. So does this match up with the story of King Solomon as well? Of course it does. Solomon is said to have had, quote, 1,400 chariots in 1 Kings 1:26. This represents a prodigious army by ancient standards, and one which could only have been amassed over a long period of time by an established civilization. Such a thing did not exist in ancient Palestine, but it did exist in ancient Egypt. Simply was not possible in the context of the primitive Levant region, folks. Plus, we're told that only 5 years after the great King Solomon's death, the Egyptian pharaoh Shishak and his allies had invaded Judah and captured its fortified cities with little or no military resistance, according to 2 Chronicles 12. So if there was little or no resistance, how could that be when, you know, just prior to that time, we're told that Solomon had this great army with horsemen and chariots? You see the problem. If, in fact, there was this great army of horsemen and chariots, there's no way that Pharaoh so easily could have overtaken them. He may have if he called in for help, but initially it would have been a disaster, right? And it says he overtook it without any effort. It would not have been without any effort. If he knew enough that they had a lot of horsemen, he would have brought a lot of reinforcements, but it still would have been a dragged out battle. It would have taken time before he could finally overcome them if they had this great army of chariots and horses. They didn't have it. Egyptians did. Look at the lies, guys. On and on every freaking page of that book. And yet, how many millions still accept it, not only as a divine guidebook, they accept it as a history book, even a science book, right? All the times I've talked in the past about all the scientific nonsense in that book of gibberish. Wow. Bible adds that Jerusalem itself was spared only after delivering up the entirety of King Solomon's accumulated wealth to Shishak. But if there were so many chariots, again, such as what's described in the Old Testament, you wouldn't have a surrender like that at all. Certainly not right away without any fight going on. What a bunch of malarkey. According to the Bible, the empire inherited by Solomon was weakened during the course of his reign. The king faced troubles in Edom, and his influence in Syria was also weakened when Rehoboam is said to have seized Damascus and then made himself king there. Exact parallels to these rebellions are found in the Amarna letters, as it turns out, pertaining, of course, to the reign of Amenhotep III. Letters sent by Canaanite kings, especially Abdi Kiba of Jerusalem, speak of continuous trouble in the area of Edom and southern Canaan. Imagine that, guys. One such letter stated, quote, "All the king's land is rebellious." The situation in northern Syria was far worse, matching up again with the biblical account. The northern Mesopotamian kingdom of Mitanni had begun to reassert its influence over city-states in northern Syria in an attempt to take back control of that region from Egypt. Amenhotep III responded to this threat with a peace treaty with the king of Mitanni and by marrying two Mitanni princesses. That's always the way to consolidate a friendship, right? With a royal dignitary intermarry, usually through trickery or bribery or falsely promising gold and then not carrying out with that promise. He also, Amenhotep III, also sent the king of Mitanni 30 units of gold each year. Apparently he did come through on that promise when it suited his interests. In return for his protecting the northern Syrian section of the Egyptian or Hyksosian Empire. That area was a little weak, so okay, I'll send you gold as long as you continue to protect it so that the empire didn't weaken. They wanted an empire of the world, guys, even back then, but realized they couldn't do it alone, so they had to bribe or intermarry or, you know, whatever it took to get other kings to cooperate to help protect their territories. But Amenhotep's troubles in the area were not over yet. Toward the end of his reign, the king's authority over the northern part of the empire, including Damascus, was endangered by, you know, powerful the powerful Hittite king Sulupununma the first. The Hittites also posed a threat to Mitanni, Egypt's ally in the area. Do understand, though, all these names we're referring to here are mentioned, as we cited a moment ago, in the Old Testament as nations that were a threat to, quote, King Solomon. Anyway, Akizi, ruler of the northern Syria city of Katna, a few miles north of Kadesh, which was a Hittite territory, or Syro-Hittite, you know, they were allies, spoke of these dangers in letters to Amenhotep III in the Amarna letters. Here's one quote from one of these letters. To King Emuria, or Amenhotep III, that's what he was known to them as, son of the sun. Isn't that interesting? Son of God, in other words. Son of the sun, my lord, thus says this thy servant Akizi, meaning himself, the king of the Hittites sends forth, as for me, I am with thee, king, meaning King Amenhotep. I am with thee and with the land of Egypt. So assuring him, I'm on your side. I'm going to fight, you know, to protect your territories. The parallels between Solomon and Amenhotep III, once again, guys, are just astonishing. They never end. Here's yet some more. Oh, well, actually, let's look at some interesting butt-kissing, shall we? Vassal kings were made to kiss the hind parts of Amenhotep III. Now, we've already seen some of that, right? You know, send us some more gold, O king, and we'll send you our daughters. You know, just eating out of his hand. It's so disgusting. But isn't that how so many rulers today operate with the tribe? Of course they do. I talked before about, you know, WTO. Oh, guys, when I think of what went on, the WTO protests in Seattle back in 1999. That's happened in other cities too, but that one I am particularly familiar with because I studied it quite a bit and did a show on it a long time ago. Is it disgusting? Legitimate protesters gathered waving their banners or whatever, you know, to protest what was going on. They knew that the WTO was, even at that early stage, 99, had already made some great progress into raping our economy and controlling our foreign policy, right? So you know what they did? Our beloved government, under Clinton's behest, sent in saboteurs to delegitimize the legitimate protesters, right? To make them look bad. They went in wearing masks so nobody could tell who they were. They called themselves the Black Bloc Group. And, you know, they were smashing windshields, you know, blah, blah, blah. And the legitimate protesters were telling local reporters, we don't know who these people are. We have nothing to do with them. We're here peacefully just trying to get our message out. That was not reported nationally, only locally. In the meantime, they told local police not to respond to these masked marauders that were doing all this damage, right? They were smashing storefront windows, smashing windshields, you know, on and on and on. Anyway, why did I get off on this tangent? Because there's our tribe once again, guys, using the power of money to control everything. People in this country think your vote matters, think this government is working on your behalf, while yet all the while our jobs are going overseas. The few we have left are paying dirt shit. They're not paying any benefits. Illegals are deliberately allowed to flood into this country. I mean, it just goes on and on and on. How did this happen? Sure, a great many of our leaders are tribe members anyway and would have done this just for that reason. But no, there are many others that aren't tribe members but yet are still going along with the plan. Why? The power of money. That's why. The same game and the same people. One Amarna letter addressed to Amenhotep III states, to the king... Oh, I think I just read this, right? yeah, my lord, blah, blah, blah. Oh, I guess I didn't finish it. Yeah, to the king, my lord, the sun god from heaven. Oh, no, this is another one. I didn't read this one. The sun god from heaven. See, notice how they're addressing him as a god while yet alive. Unheard of, guys, in Egyptian history. This is the tribe for you. Thy servant, meaning himself, the servant of the king, and the dirt under his 2 feet. I got to stop right there, guys. The dirt under his feet. I'm not only serving you, oh great king, you Hyksosian piece of shit, but I'm serving the dirt under your feet. Doesn't that sound familiar? Where do we find a reference in the not-so-holy book about dirt under the feet? Yahweh promised his tribe, I will bring all nations before you. They will bow before you and lick the dust from the soles of your feet. And now we see this ancient king telling, you know, Solomon, i.e. Amenhotep III, that he not only bows to him, but to the dust under his feet. Are you shitting me? Tell me you don't see the connection there. The ground, he says, which you tread at the 2 feet of the king, my lord, the sun god from heaven, seven times I fall. Now that's interesting too, isn't it? Seven times seven. We have Jesus telling Peter to forgive 70 times seven, right? The whole Bible, Old Testament and New, is overwhelmingly infatuated with the number seven, right? And here, this ancient king is telling Amenhotep III, seven times seven I fall. That's the Jubilee year, by the way. Seven sevens, 49, and then on the 50th year, they had the Jubilee. After seven sevens, seven times seven. So there's another reference to this in the Not-So-Holy book. Look at the parallels, guys. They're endless. They're endless. As a matter of fact, I only picked the best ones. There were so many more that I was uncovering as I was putting these notes together. It's just endless. Anyway, the butt kissing by vassal kings went much further than this. Here's another quote from another Amarna letter. If the king should write for my wife, request my wife, this is another king talking to Amenhotep III, if the king should write for my wife, how could I withhold her? Listen to the ass licking here. This king is promising this tribal piece of shit, oh, how could I refuse you? Just ask and I'll give her to you. Look at the sellout of this king's own daughter. If the king, meaning Amenhotep III, if the king should write to me, plunge a bronze dagger into thy heart and die, how could I refuse to carry out the command of the king? Can you believe this, guys? Look how low these sorry-ass bastard, non-tribal, what was supposed to be Gentile kings, look how low they sunk to say something like this. He's not only pledging to give his daughter to this piece of shit scoundrel, but he's telling him, if you should tell me to plunge a dagger into my heart and kill myself, how could I refuse to carry out the command of the king? Wow. This reminds me of a passage in the book of Job where Job says, though he slay me, yet will I trust him, meaning Yahweh. You can kill me, Yahweh, and I'm still going to trust you. Do you see the parallels here? The tribe wanted you to have that mentality with their God and with them themselves when they're in power. Here's a Gentile king telling this Hyksosian piece of shit, if you told me to stab myself with a dagger, I would do it. Look at this crap, guys. Look how low they have gotten so many who should know better to sink over the centuries. Look how they get so many today to sink. There's a lot of non-tribal members that are part of their little clique, guys, that are in high positions of power that are selling out their own populations on a daily basis with the same kind of ass-licking horse shit. Ask me to jump, I'll jump. Just make sure my pocket has some of those shekels stuffed in them at the end of the day. I don't care. I'll do anything. I'll sell up my own mother if I have to.
Has anything changed in the past 3,500 years since the time of Mr. Amenhotep III? Sadly, not a goddamn thing. Nothing. Oh, is this vomit-inducing. We're told of some butt-kissing done to King Solomon, or ultimately Amenhotep III, by at least one royal figure in the Bible as well, the Queen of Sheba. This is found in, let's see, do I have time? Yeah, I got time. This is found in 1 Kings 10, 6-9. Listen to the butt-kissing. Sounds so familiar to what we were just reading in the Amarna letters about King Amenhotep III, right? Listen to this. Sheba said, it quotes her, "Then she said to the king, Solomon, 'It was a true report which I heard in my own land about you and your words and your wisdom. However,' she said, 'I did not believe the words until I came and saw with my own eyes. And indeed, the half was not told me.'" In other words, "You're even greater than the things I heard about you." What a bunch of horse shit. "Your wisdom and prosperity exceed the fame of which I heard." Well, I don't doubt that his prosperity exceeded. Oh, yes. They're great thieves, aren't they? But his wisdom, cut the shit. She's licking his ass. Just like, who even knows if there was a queen of Sheba? It doesn't matter, though, does it? Look at the parallels between her licking his ass, right? And what we just read from the Amarna letters. Same thing, right? Solomon and Amenhotep III were one and the same. This passage goes on. "Happy are your men, and happy are these young servants of yours. Who stand continually before you and hear your wisdom. Happy are they who are able to stand before you and hear your words." I'll give you a break. "Blessed be the Lord your God, who delighted in you, setting you on the throne of Israel." Anyways, you got the point. Absolutely disgusting. There's even more parallels, guys. We'll finish these notes up next week. Have a great week. We'll see you then. Take care.
Hard time pronouncing some of the ingredients in your personal care products? Do you even know what those chemicals are? You should. Everything you put onto your body ends up getting into your body, so you better be sure that you are using quality products every day. We know it's often hard to find really good natural products, and when you do find them, they're often very expensive. That's why we have Heathen Herbs. Give us a try. We have affordable herbal tinctures, tooth powder, deodorant, muscle salves, creams, beeswax, cling wrap, gift baskets, magnesium, iodine, throat spray, face spray, hairspray, cleaning spray, bug spray, linen spray, and so much more. We're coming out with new products all the time so that you can replace all the corporate crap. Use coupon code RENEGADE for 10% off everything at heathenherbs.com.